thing is most people purchase out of aspiration. And I mean that not in a grandiose way, but like if I'm buying, if I don't have any toilet paper, I need to buy toilet paper. Let's go back to that example.
Yeah.
It's I have holes in my socks and I need new socks. But if I want to buy a surf clothing company, I want to buy their clothes, it might be because I wish that I was a Southern California surfer, but instead I'm living in, you know, Michigan right now, just as an example. Like that, it's sometimes aspirational. And so you have to understand who is aspiring to be the brand that you have created. And that's how you should design your brand and your target and separate those two. That's super important. If you do that right, you create awareness in your target audience with your brand identity that they're aspiring to be. That's where you, a lot of times, you can win.
Helping you create loyal customers and loyal employees all through the power of simplicity. This is the Simple Brand Podcast, now heard around the world, including Waukesha, Wisconsin. I'm your host, Matt Lyles, and this week I'm talking with Eric Huberman. Eric's the founder and CEO of Hawk Media, the fastest growing marketing consultancy in the United States that's helped develop marketing strategies for more than 3,000 businesses. And Eric's the author of the USA Today bestseller, The Hawk Method, the three principles of marketing that made over 3,000 brands soar. Eric and I discussed the Hawk Method principles along with how any brand can apply them, no matter their budget. So here it is. Here's my interview with Eric Huberman.
Hey, Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited about this. I'm excited to learn more from you and your principles. But before we get into your principles, I want to talk more about your background and how you've grown Hawk Media.
Sure. Background depends how far I go back, but let's just, I guess, start post-college. I went into real estate in 2008, 1 week before Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, which felt relevant a year ago. Now feels way too relevant.
Right.
What happened this past weekend, but...
Interesting timing.
Yeah, Silicon Valley Bank gone, which is crazy. So I graduated in 2008, and a week later that happened. And the difference was that I don't think it was managed as well then. And so that began the collapse of our economy for a little while. And so I made $350 that year being in commercial real estate, and quickly started sort of scrambling to figure out what I do instead. And long story short, I ended up starting an online music company, ran that for a year or 2 years. Was profitable, hired a CEO to take it over, and then built and sold two e-commerce subscription companies consecutively in 2010 and 2012. 2012 and 2013. And then in 2013, after selling the last one, I started advising consulting for a bunch of brands on how to grow their revenue using marketing. I was working with some big brands like Red Bull, Verizon, HP, as well as a lot of startups. And I just found that it was really hard for these companies to find great marketing help. Like 99% of agencies have no idea what they're doing. And the few that are good tend to get really expensive, want long contracts, high minimums, something that makes them hard to work with too. And it's still the same way. There's very few talented, scaled agencies that work with small and medium and growth stage businesses. And so I just got sick of it, decided to hire my own team. So we started with seven people, each with their own expertise, a Facebook marketer, an email marketer, a web designer, a fractional CMO, et cetera. Nice. Went back to these companies and said, everything's a la carte, month to month, cheaper than hiring in-house. Basically, we can spin up what you need, when you need it, and ebb and flow as your needs change. And that's how we started. Fast forward, we're over 9 years old now. We have 250, give or take, people. We're on our second venture fund, a $50 million fund. We've got a data and AI platform called Hawk AI. And continuing to grow and build.
So you've, I guess, taken those lessons that you've been sharing to help yourself grow. At the same time, you've helped a lot of other brands significantly grow.
Yeah, it's about 4,500 brands at this point that we've helped grow.
That's a pretty significant number.
It's fun. It's been a good ride so far. And that's exactly it. We drink our own punch, though. Like we've always marketed ourselves the same way we're telling other people to. It's like, it's so funny to me that there's so many agencies out there that don't know how to grow their own business, but they tout themselves as able to grow others. It's like, well, that doesn't make sense. And part of the fun of this is like a lot of the times I'm talking to our companies that we're running marketing for owner to owner about like how this is what we're seeing, this is how we're managing it. Like, and not just talking about marketing, we're talking about like HR and like accounting, finance, and how are you dealing with collections problems and blah, 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 you know, like all the things you deal with. Like, because we truly know how to build businesses, it's helped on the venture side, but it also helps us be a real partner because it's like we actually understand how marketing fits into the puzzle versus just selling services.
Yeah. So looking at the overall experience of of not just growing the brand, but growing the business itself too.
Exactly.
Well, when it comes to growing brands, what do you think is the big thing that brands need to consider if they want to grow?
Number one, have a good product or service. I think a lot of people think they can market their way out of and it's just not. But that's not the most interesting answer, but that's the quick answer. I would also say unit economics is a big one. Comes up a lot now, like having good margins, making sure you can profit. Because the reason I say that is because if those two things are in place, marketing works very well. Because then you can compete. You're able to spend the money you need to on marketing. If you have good margins and a good product, you should be fine doing a lot of things in marketing. Because good products always also create word of mouth and repeat purchases. Like these are all things that matter. And then from there, the kind of world's your oyster. There's so many tools out there to get out there. There's so many different things you can do. And usually if you have those two first things, you can do everything and it'll work. That's what's fun is if you have a great product or service that people want and you have good margins on it, and you're able to make money, you can go for it. The biggest thing I see people miss is the idea of a purchase cycle or consideration period. Like the fact that it takes time from when people are introduced to your company to when they actually buy something. And it's usually, you know, several weeks to months. People are baffled by it. So they look at all their marketing, like I spent $1,000 today. How much did I make? Don't look at it that way. That is a whole fallacy. Really start to understand what your sales cycle is for your product. Even if it's a small consumer product, it takes weeks.
Yeah. So try to balance out and understand how to play that long game.
Yeah, exactly. It's a working capital situation just as much as supply chain is. Like you have to pay for products and then ship it from China and blah, blah, blah. And a lot of people go get what's called factoring or financing for that period of time. You can physically see that it takes time. The thing is, like, so does marketing. Most people don't understand that, though. So they think that they can just get paid back immediately. And just, you know, my favorite line from our clients is always like, well, if you, you know, make 10 times my money, then I'll keep giving you money. I'm like, oh, really? If you give me $1 and I give you 10, you'll just keep giving me money? Like, crazy. Who would have thought? But that the amount of people that say that is actually kind of baffling. That being said, that actually happens. It's just a lot of times the issue isn't you give me $1 and I give you 10. That's actually a very it's a pretty achievable goal. It's just that might take a year to give you the 10 back. And that's the part that people don't understand.
So how do you go about understanding how much time that should take based on your own industry, based on your business?
Generally, industry is really misleading in terms of that type of data, because a lot of times it's more average order value than industry. So it's the price point. And so what we've seen e-commerce wise, unless it's something that takes a lot more trust to build, on average, for a $50 purchase, it's 3 weeks. For a $100 purchase, it's 5 weeks. $200, 6 weeks. And it tapers off between 2 and 3 months for any type of impulse buy. Past that, and you're probably in a different category type of purchase. And so what we've seen is, like, you just want to monitor. Like, look at when people clicked your site to when they bought, when they submitted an email address to when they bought. Like, understand those timelines. They're easy to grab. You have to get historical data. So in the beginning of the business, it's all testing and trying. But at some point, start looking at the data, collect it, and keep working through it too. And also keep revisiting that data because it might shift and change. And you should be trying to do things to accelerate that time period. That's where, you know, we're going to talk about the principles, but the three principles of marketing we talk about are awareness, nurturing, and trust. Nurturing is all about accelerating that sales cycle as well as guaranteeing a higher conversion rate. So like making sure that more people stay in the funnel, get through it faster.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, so yeah, jumping right in, these are the three basic principles: awareness, nurturing, and trust. So when it comes to awareness, do you think there's a challenge in helping leaders understand the right tactics, the right steps that they need to take based on that amount of time to grow the awareness?
Yeah, it's really figuring out what your budget constraints are. Like I just talked to a company about this. You have to invest up front. So like, what can you afford to invest for the first 6 months, knowing that it might not make an ROI? Let's just assume it makes zero. What can you afford there? And then figure out not spreading that too thin. Like we really like to see minimum $5,000, if not minimum, you know, but more optimally $10,000 spent on each of these sort of digital channels before switching to another one or adding another one. So that's Facebook, Google, TikTok. And then figuring out like what to spend on, meaning like whether let's take the two best performers still to this day, which are Meta and Google. TikTok's getting up there really fast, but I saw they're trying to propose another bill to ban it. So we'll see what happens. But taking Meta and Google, the way to think about them is Facebook and Instagram are a place where you can create new demand for a company. So like people are scrolling through their feed, doing nothing productive. You know what their interests are. You know that they're bored. You can serve up something and be like, hey, we exist. And if you're hitting the right socioeconomic info, the right interest base, et cetera, you can probably get a purchase. Like if you have a product that people want and you can hit the right audience, that's why it's been so powerful. Google, people are proactively trying to find something. So if you're solving a problem, right, Google is a better solution. So the comparison would be here is like Facebook's probably better for launching a new hack company, Melon, I've seen everywhere. So as an example, like people aren't Googling for a new baseball. Nobody like goes in and like, I need a Google hat. Like that's not how people shop. Yeah. But if you're on Facebook and you see an ad for an awesome hat that looks great and like has all these selling points, you might buy it right there. So it's like you can create that demand, and or you might not buy it right there, but now you're interested. You might go give them your email address. Like, this is cool. Maybe I'll buy this somewhere. Yeah. Like that's frankly how I've watched Melon grow as an example. Then you have on Google, it's more like someone that's serving a need. So it could be, a pain relief cream, like being the top search for pain relief. And I just saw a stat, like the interesting thing is now purchases, 61% of product purchases last year were done on, those numbers don't make sense. I just realized that I saw a chart that was like 61% were done on Amazon, 49% on Google, but that doesn't add up to 100%. So that's weird. But I was just about to quote a study I saw. Probably should check the reference, but I'm actually going to look it up. We're talking about it.
Close.
The point being, though, is for those types of products, if you can serve a need, that's where you want to be. You want to be on Amazon. You want to be on Google. Facebook's going to be a little harder because if I don't have any pain, I don't need your pain relief cream. If you're a DUI attorney and I don't have a DUI on Facebook, you can try to target like people that like Mercedes and Jack Daniels, but that's probably not going to get you that many DUI people. Yeah. Whereas Google, DUI attorney is what I'm targeting. It's a lot more direct, a lot easier.
This may be based on either industry or based on product or based on price, but generally, how many times do you think a customer needs to see something before they actually buy it?
That impression count number is always such a general number. Like it was 7 forever, and now it's probably 22 is the number I've heard. I don't know that there is a direct. I think it depends on the product, depends on who you are. Like, there's products you can have 2 impressions and you're going to buy it. There's products that you need to see for the next 2 years. Like, again, it depends what you're selling. If you're selling something that's like going to cure my ailments, like it's a medicine or it's some sort of longevity or has to do with my health, probably takes a lot more trust. If you're going to make me ingest something, you're going to have to build a lot of trust. If it's a t-shirt, if I like the t-shirt, I might just buy it.
Yeah.
You know? So where US consumers start their search when shopping online, the percentage of respondents, this is such a weird stat because it does say 61% said Amazon, 49% said search. So I remembered the numbers, right? I don't know how it makes any sense because apparently 32% Walmart, 20% YouTube, 19%. So I'm misunderstanding this stuff. Oh, because they could select multiple options.
Yeah, there's overlap. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just overlap, but 61% Amazon, 49% search engine, 32% Walmart, 20% YouTube, 19% Facebook, 15% Instagram, 11% TikTok.
But the number one there is Amazon.
Amazon.
Wow.
Amazon quickly become the first place people look. Remember, if you think about it, though, people aren't searching for lifestyle, like fun products. It's not like I'm Googling for jacket. I'm not Googling for people buy a lot on impulse. And that's where Facebook and Instagram come in. When I'm actually proactively searching for something, it's probably because I need toilet paper or I need something, like I need a product. I need snacks, whatever it is. And that's why, like, of course, I'm going to Amazon for that stuff. And if not, going to Google. Like, that's the point is, like, depending on where you serve the market that way, that's where you want to be.
Gotcha. Yeah. And usually, like, when you need it, there's some level of urgency there.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, I need it today. I need a same day delivery today. Or, you know what? I know that I'm going to need it and need it delivered within 2 days or before next week. So there's
which is why post-COVID, less than 20 or around 20% of purchases are online and 80% in store. Because if I need something, I'm just going to run down to the store and get it. Like that's still like brick and mortar is still much more powerful than in the internet, and probably will be for a lot of products, especially food and beverage and home products. Yeah. Like it's going to be that way because not that many people plan ahead. It's like, oh, I'm out. Shoot. How many times have you been in the shower and you're like, I'm in the shampoo and you're squeezing it out. So you run down and get more shampoo.
That does speak to the sense of urgency of when we actually need something and we're going to go grab it.
Totally.
Well, so how do we know if we're approaching awareness the right way?
you know, because you're getting a ton of interest. I think it's that simple. It's you're getting people into your funnel and then eventually converting it. Because if your conversion's low, it's either because of how you're handling your funnel or you might be targeting the wrong people. So like that's the part of awareness that's super important, is make sure you're set up to target the right people. And I'd say one other catch there that people really confuse is, don't confuse target audience with your sort of brand target, so to speak. Your brand voice, your branding, and the who actually that intrigues is very different. So what I mean by that is, your brand might be, let's say you're a surf company, and your brand is everything about Southern California, surfer culture, that kind of thing, now as an example, and you build that out. That doesn't mean that, like, you know, being someone that lives in LA, like, I've seen 1,000 of those brands. I might not buy your brand, I don't care, but that might appeal to someone in the Midwest that wants to feel, when they wear this clothes, like they're hanging out on the beach in California, and whatever that means in their head. So your target and your brand identity are very different things, and people confuse that a lot. So they'll build their brand identity to be this Southern California person, and then they'll target all Southern California people. The thing is most people purchase out of aspiration. And I mean that not in a grandiose way, but like, if I'm buying if I don't have any toilet paper, I need to buy toilet paper. Let's go back to that example.
Yeah.
If I have holes in my socks, I might need new socks. But if I want to buy a surf clothing company, I want to buy their clothes, might be because I wish that I was a Southern California surfer, but instead I'm living in, you know, Michigan right now, just as an example. Like that, it's sometimes aspirational. And so you have to understand who is aspiring to be the brand that you have created. And that's how you should design your brand and your target and separate those two. That's super important. If you do that right, you create awareness in your target audience with your brand identity that they're aspiring to be. That's where a lot of times you can win.
Wow. I think too few brands understand that understand that that aspirational audience. So how can you go about making sure that you've defined that aspirational audience correctly?
You're going to get intrigued. It's just that simple. People are going to want to be a part of the brand. People are going to want to buy your stuff. Like you see that excitement about the brand versus just the products. That's when you've done it right. Is like people like want to get involved. They feel like they're connected to you. Again, it's aspirational. It's hitting that emotional part of them. It's like, I wish I was that and you're that. So I want to be a part of this. And so like my last company was an activewear brand that thankfully had an incredible marketing team and we nailed it. And like the rabid nature of our audience was incredible. The company was Ellie. She was, you know, your 27-year-old older sister, Southern California girl, you know, liked to take yoga, was adventurous, liked to travel. Like we designed this person that was like, frankly, a very easy to identify person, but it was like what everyone wanted to be. And what it turned out was it was frankly a slightly older audience that appealed to us. It was more like the 35 to 45. They wanted to be 27, Southern California, yogi, single, fun, traveler. Like that's who was like, I missed that and I want to be that person. And that's who we appealed to. So we targeted a little bit of an older demo, but we positioned ourselves as this, you know, younger, fun girl.
Gotcha. Well, then, so do you think that aspiration audience can change over time?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's again, brand's appeal changes. You know, Ed Hardy is a great example of this, that it went from like ultra premium t-shirt company that like was the celebrity go-to to then selling Costco and being like the everyday. And like, there was, you know, brands go through transitions. That was self-perpetuated in a lot of ways because of the way they distributed. Like once they're in Costco, I don't think celebrities saw it as premium kind of thing, but, definitely.
Gotcha.
I wonder if I could make a comeback. I feel like Ed Hardy, like that could almost come full circle at this point. It's been like 20 years.
Yeah. I would think so. And, you know, and maybe it depends on how it's positioned. If you position.
Everyone's wearing Von Dutch hats. Yeah. Like Gen Z's all in Von Dutch hats. I'm like, this is incredible.
Yeah.
My buddy was there about, so that story is crazy. That company.
You know, there's so many brands that have somewhat of a, maybe it's like a cyclical desire or cyclical approach, and you know, like what's old is new again. That always happens.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about nurturing. How do you balance the actions needed in nurturing?
Yeah, so nurturing awareness is how do you introduce people to your product or service, not how do you sell. Just how do you introduce? How do you get people in your funnel? Nurturing is what after that to get them to a sale. That's what we call nurturing. And just to be clear, I've got to promote the Hawk method. That's what this the principle. That's what we're discussing. So it's the book we put out. And Yeah. So nurturing is basically all the tactics you use to stay in touch with that person during that consideration period, that purchase cycle, sales cycle, and then also post-purchase to keep them coming back, because you really need to keep selling to someone, because getting a customer is expensive and hard. You have to have ways to keep making money off them if you want to compete. And so the tools generally, email marketing, SMS marketing, creating content on your site that engage people above and beyond a purchase decision. Like, again, we talk about this aspiration. So if your aspiration is Southern California surf, well, what are the top beaches I should visit in California? What are ways to enjoy surfing anywhere in the country? All these things that it's like, if that's the aspiration, let's create content around that. So I engage people above and beyond just buying something, which inherently will have them buying more. They'll build more trust with them. They'll get them just aware of us more. They'll remind them of us. So content's super powerful. Having a great website, super important, so that you can get through that. And then there's many other tactics, but those are really the big buckets.
And when it comes to content, it sounds like having education play a role in that content is valuable.
It can be. Entertainment is also super valuable. So it doesn't always have to be education. So it's entertainment or education. I'd say the thing is, one thing I love about content is it's way more shareable than products. So a lot of times your audience, they're not going to share a pair of your shorts that you're selling, but you create a great listicle or blog post, they'll share that with their friends, increasing word of mouth, perpetuating your brand. So creating great content that's shareable is a really powerful tool.
I think I get this, but I don't think enough brands understand the need. And or maybe it's those brand leaders. It's those in the C-suite. They're saying, okay, so we create content and we're just trying to get them to, we're trying to get them to buy. So this content needs to be pushing towards a sale. And it sounds like that's not the case.
You want engagement. And one caution and thing with content is like ChatGPT and all that coming out. Like, I do have a little bit of a fear that we're already so flooded with content. Like, the days of a PR hit actually driving any real business to a company are over. Warby Parker, I know those guys a little bit, and they credit the early success of Warby Parker with a GQ article. That's really what kicked them off. They got a GQ article for Warby Parker and it really set them up. There's a few companies that, the Oprah Effect, Shark Tank, these things. Problem is there's so much content now. There's no concentration of content, no concentration of audience, I should say. So it's not like you get a big PR hit and it just drives a ton of business anymore. Unless it goes viral on all of social, is a little different. But the content in and of itself, the piece of PR, doesn't do it. And so it's become like, as you create content, also know that it's so flooded now. If you're not creating content that's really compelling to your audience, it's going to be just noise and just a wasted effort. And I do worry that with ChatGPT, because people now are typing in three words and getting a full essay and then just publishing, it's going to create so much noise. I'm curious how companies are going to rise above that and keep engagement. What might happen, because this happened in music too, is it actually gets more concentrated and harder to break through, where it's like, now it's like, if you already have an audience, they're reading your articles, they're never going to leave because they don't want to deal with the mess that is the general world. They're just going to go where they go.
So what do you think's the solution? Do you think it's finding and doubling down on smaller audiences?
I think it's using content not as a way to create awareness, but as a way to create trust and nurture. I think that's how you have to look at it now. So again, it's about PR and all these things as ways to your existing audience to feed them, not to go grab new people. And I think that's probably for now going to work. Now the things, and this is different for every company, but it's going to depend on how your audience consumes content and what they're missing. Are they lacking something? Because again, if you start creating a bunch of blog posts that nobody cares about, well, that's just a wasted effort. So it's like, how can you really provide value for these people? Do you really, let's say it was the surf company, you put something out about the top 10 beaches in California. Are there not enough lists about the top 10 beaches in California? Did that really create anything? You really have to see, where is something missing that I can add value? In every aspect of your business, this is important.
So then how do you find that out? How do you find out what your audience is missing?
I think you need to know your market incredibly well and everything that plays in it, and then be just observant and thoughtful and smart. Honestly, the answer there is you have to just pay attention and go, why isn't this, doesn't this exist for, I'll use Hawk Media as an example, because obviously I paid a lot of attention to our own marketing.
Yeah.
I got fat, everybody would talk about, my friend gets 10 or 20 times returns on their ad spend and I'm only getting 8. What's that? I'm like, your friend's lying to you. Shut up. And so I was why isn't there an S&P 500 for marketing, where it's these are the metrics that people are seeing on average. And so for wealth managers, it's if I'm beating the S&P, I'm winning. If we're beating the averages, we're winning. So why doesn't that exist? And so I ended up taking, it took 8 years, but we built it. We built a benchmarking tool that's Hawk AI, where it's like, we have 8,000 companies' marketing data. So don't tell me you're getting these returns and everyone else is getting this. Here's the actual data and what everybody is seeing. And this is how you compare. And we can actually see down to like, you know, small KPIs, like this is exactly what click-through rates on Facebook are. This is where you stand according to your industry. And so again, that's how we built it. Now we're launching benchmark reports off that and we're allowing people to use it. That became a piece of content and a tool for us because we knew the market needed it. You hopefully know your market and figure out what they need.
Gotcha. Okay. So just knowing your market, listening to them, observing them, then knowing what they need.
Yep, exactly.
So, well, what are some of the big mistakes you see when it comes to nurturing?
Big mistakes I see when it comes to nurturing. Overdoing it, spamming people, blanket emails every day, not creating triggers based on behavior and figuring out, like, taking some time, not creating value in nurturing. So, want to buy? Here's 10% off. Want to buy? What do you think? You should buy. Like, no. Like, think of it as a person. Like, hey, we saw you wanted to buy this. You know, here's some other things you might want to know since you're thinking about it. You know, hey, you know, here's some trust factors. Here's some third-party validation. Like, here's some PR we got. Here's some celebrities that are using the products. Like, here's some other stuff. Hey, here are our top sellers. If you're having analysis paralysis on which to buy, let us explain it to you. Like, think about why are people not buying right away? Let's provide that for them. And then also, let's provide other understanding of, like, who we are as a brand, because 75% of people won't buy from a company they don't inherently trust. So build that trust. Even if you're a t-shirt, is that t-shirt going to be scratchy? Is it going to fit me right? Like, why do I know that you actually care what happens to me after I give you money? Like, that's a big part of it.
So it sounds like focusing on building the relationship.
Yeah, correct.
Cool. And then that leads to the third principle, trust.
Yeah. Yep. Synonymous with brand too. It's like, initially, when nobody knows who you are, trust comes from third-party validation. Because if I'm like, what if we showed up? I was hoping I'd like invite him and sitting here somewhere, but if I showed up, I'm like, just take this pill. Trust me. You'd never met me before. You'd be like, no, what? But if I came up to you with a Harvard professor who you knew they were, and they're like, hey, this pill really can help you. Like, if you're feeling a little tired today, this has no negative effects. It doesn't even come with a crash, but it's going to help you. You're going to look at the Harvard professor, and then we show, and here's a study, you know, that's published in Nature, one of the top scientific publications. Like, here's this, here's that. Do you want to take the pill now? Okay. Even if I still just met you off the street, which is kind of, you know, metaphorical, like meeting someone on a Facebook ad, you're like, Harvard professor, if I can validate that.
Right.
In Nature, but it's like, and this is going to make me feel better. Like, okay, now you've given me enough evidence that I'll give it a shot. That's the idea, obviously. And so that's a weird example, obviously. I'm just trying to use a real world kind of example, but the idea is like that third party validation wasn't me, some random person, some random brand just telling you that we have a great product. I had this expert. I had this PR. I had all these other things. It's like, okay, I trust you a little more now. And that's important in the beginning. Reviews, testimonials. By the way, I mean, ask anyone, do you believe reviews are 100% true? Like when you see 500 Amazon reviews on a product, if you take a step back, do you go, oh, those are definitely 500 customers that love the product that were out of the blue? Nobody believes that.
No.
But how often do you look at the reviews when you go buy a product on Amazon or go to a restaurant, you're looking on Yelp? Like, do you look at reviews and what are they rated?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I do. So yes.
That kind of gone wrong for me, but yes, exactly. That's the point. Yes. We all know that they're kind of made up, but still just that little bit of you got some other people that say something positive is enough for us to go, okay, I'll give this a shot.
For me personally, and I think there are some people that think this way too, as long as there is an acceptable volume of reviews, if there's five reviews, and I know, you know, always like the first handful of reviews are going to be that person's mom, that person's wife, or whoever else, and discount those.
And again, I don't think that anyone doesn't know this. You know how easy it is to go buy 100 reviews off out of the Philippines or India? Like, if you can game that system, but still, we all know this. I know this inherently, but I still go look at the same thing. Do they have a critical mass of reviews?
And are they
positive? And so that, again, validation. These are all things that matter to everybody. It's human nature. You want third-party validation. There's my favorite example of this. You ever watch How I Met Your Mother?
Yes, yeah.
So Barney Stinson, which is Neil Patrick Harris, and Ted, the main character, So Barney's always trying to help Ted meet girls. That's the whole show. And Barney will walk up to random girls and just go, have you met Ted?
Yeah.
They don't know Barney. But it's just like the introduction is enough. And it's like a funny joke in the show, but it is such a descript, like it's so perfect in how humans work. Where it's like, I don't know you, but because you introduced me to you, I now trust you because that person validated you. And that's how it works early on with a brand. If I might not know who you are, but as long as you get some validation, it's like, even if you like, and this is like, don't be too sleazy in business, it'll catch up to you, but you could make people do this. Make up a website. Like, let's say you're launching a surf company, buy bestsurfbrands.com and give yourself the award for the best surf brand of the year from bestsurfbrands.com. Boom. Does work. It's shady, but that's just illustrating the point of like these, that's the kind of stuff that like do it the right way. Maybe go actually win an award, but these are things that work. Then from there, over time, what you deliver consistently becomes your brand, which becomes that trust. So what I mean by that is good and bad. So, and also what you highlight. The best way to example is like Zappos. Zappos was known for customer service. They were incredible. They'd spend hours on the phone with customers just to talk about their family and just were always there for their customers. And so people trusted to buy. And this was important at that period in e-commerce where people still weren't sure if they could trust buying stuff off the internet, but Zappos was trustworthy. They were there. They cared about customer service and they knew they were good at that, but then they reinforced it. They wrote a book on customer service. All they talked about was customer service. They told people this is what they stand for. And then people believed it. And confirmation bias starts to play a part in this, where it's like, if you tell me you say over and over again, we care about customer service. If I have a bad experience with their customer service, I'm going to believe it's an anomaly. Well, but they're known for customer service. So that was weird. That's odd. And so I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and probably give them another shot. Vice versa. Let's take the cable companies. Comcast and Cox are known for horrible customer service. And so if I have a good experience with them, my thought is going to be like, wow, at least they have one good person there. Not like maybe the headlines are wrong. It's, well, that must have been an anomaly. And when I have a bad experience, and like, see, I knew it. It's confirmation bias. Like they suck. And that's how people work. And so there's two parts of that. One is you can only control the narrative so much. So if you don't deliver well, there's going to be a lot of thing out there that you don't deliver well, and it's going to be your reputation.
Yeah.
If you do, and you talk about it, people will start to give you the benefit of the doubt in the times where you slip up, because we all slip up. Every company slips up. But it's like, and that's part of it. But that brand becomes your trust. So the other example I'd use of this is like McDonald's. It's going to taste the same everywhere. It's going to be inexpensive. It's going to be fast, like consistent. You know it. You know what you're getting with McDonald's. Yeah. It's also unhealthy. Good and bad. That's their brand.
You know,
I don't need anyone else to tell me about McDonald's. I don't need to read an article about McDonald's. McDonald's has a brand. I know what McDonald's is, and I don't eat it often at all. But if I'm going to, I know, and I don't eat it often at all because it makes me feel like, and it's not healthy. Like that's been my experience. So I'm going to run to McDonald's. That's their brand for me. And again, that's their brand for a lot of people. A lot of other people, it tastes good and it's cost effective and their priority might not be health, or they might not know about the health aspect. And so they have a huge customer base that's what they focus on. It's consistent. I like it. I'm going to go there. And that's where that brand consistency really wins, and having that reputation.
So being consistent is, well, so like once you build trust, it's consistency that helps you keep that trust.
Wait, I was going to say, if you're inconsistent, then there's no trust. You don't build anything.
Yeah.
One day that tastes this way, the other day it tastes this way, you don't know what to really get. And so what you're going to trust is that it's inconsistent. That's going to be the brand. It's all over the place, which if I'm feeling like I want a crapshoot, I'm going to go buy your brand. But if I want to, that's generally not how people want to, then there's no reason to repeat buy if it's inconsistent.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. So that's how you keep the trust, at least.
Yeah.
Well, so if you look at the three different principles, awareness, nurture, trust, do you see them as sequential or all three at once?
All three at once. It's a tripod. So kick one, I got it out. So like the reason I say that is the moment you're creating awareness, if you're not nurturing that awareness, you're losing the value of that. So it's sequential in the sense of like, you have to create awareness to nurture that awareness. Like that has to be part of it. So like there is a sequential order in terms of like, you have to create awareness to nurture that. So like if you're introducing new people to your company, then you nurture them. You can't really nurture them if you've not met them yet. So there is a sequential aspect there. Trust is through and through. Your ads to create awareness can have third-party validation or speak to your brand. So you can be creating trust from the first time you create awareness too. So it's actually like a complement to both. But if you don't have all three, you're not going to have a successful marketing campaign. Like that's the part that's super important. Like if it's no trust factor, you're just preaching to people over and over again how great you are, and they don't believe you. If there's no awareness factor, you have no new audience. You're just not going to grow. If you don't nurture it, a ton of people are going to flood in and flood out the other side and never buy anything.
Gotcha. So a constant focus on all three at once.
And really what it, the idea of it, the kind of principles and like how we talk about it is to give you a quick overview into how to dissect where your low-hanging fruit is. Where are you missing? Where are you hurting? Is it your conversion rate? Is it, if everything's functioning well, we're making tons of returns. I have this, and this is where it came from too, is 10 years of telling people like all of your conversion rate's great. You're making tons of money. Your margins are great. Spend more money. Go advertise more. Go create more awareness. Your entire funnel is incredible. Your nurturing's working. Your trust is working. You're just not introducing anyone new to it. Like, and we'd have that. Or we'd have people that are driving tons of traffic and not making any money. It's like, well, what's wrong here? Well, we should probably fix Facebook ads. No, Facebook's driving a ton of traffic. It's not converting. There's another problem. It's that it's figuring out how to triage your marketing.
So earlier you were talking about AI, and that's been kicked into high gear really recently. So
I want to say we watched Talk AI in September of last year before the rush. So it wasn't like we jumped on the bandwagon. We were building this for 8 years and then it was like, boom, which by the way, I launched Talk AI hoping that this would happen because we're not building our own, ChatGPT or Siri. Like we're not building the actual natural language processing side of this. We're building the data that then feeds that. So the fact that now some of these tools are coming out, we're actually going to plug them into what we do so we can actually have an educated marketing strategist, AI, but we're not AI engineers in that sense.
Gotcha. So then how do you see marketers being able to use AI the right way in the way that is going to help them versus just what you were talking about earlier, just create a whole lot of noise?
Yeah. Listen, it's a shortcut in a lot of ways. Like I don't disagree with using ChatGPT as a prompt. Like remember that it's regurgitating existing information out there. It's not anything new, but so are we in some senses. That's the interesting part is like every idea, I don't think anyone has an original thought. It was from something you experienced. So
there's nothing new under the sun.
Right. Exactly. So it's similar in that sense, but it's a great way to get started, but it's not, I don't know that it'll be a great way to finish ever. I don't think I think it's always going to take a human aspect to be like, does this quite fit what we're trying to do? Is this unique? Because if you don't do that, everyone's going to sound the same very quickly. Like the way you message, it's all going to run the same playbook. And that's when it's going to start failing. And it's funny, people love to be, I saw someone post this and I just appreciated it so much. It's like, everybody likes to say like, this is the end, email's dead. Email marketing's dead. Truck drivers are going to have no jobs anymore because of automated driving. Like it's done. The whole industry's gone. You realize like, I get the thesis, but human adoption's really slow. So nothing happens that quickly. So ChatGPT, I think the new iteration's coming out next week or maybe this week. Either way, it's the next week or this week. It's going to be really compelling. I think it sounds like it's way more advanced than even what we already saw. So it's like, it's going to have a lot of applications as a tool, but that's all I see it as. Honestly, I see it, could it be as innovative as the internet? Yes. Did the internet completely crush our economy because nothing mattered anymore? No. And that's how I see ChatGPT is like, it's going to be a tool that over time is going to be more and more compelling, or AI in general is going to be more and more compelling and allow us to augment and be more efficient and do things that focus on higher cognitive function, not be in the tedium of trying to come up with 10 headlines, but editing those headlines to make them more compelling, then monitoring those headlines to make sure that they actually work, then re-educating the AI to help continue to assist us. Like that's going to be what it takes.
Right.
Again, at the point that AI takes all of that over, I don't think it'll compel people because it'll all sound the same. It's like, unless you're doing something unique and creative, I think true creativity will take a long time to replace.
I'll look at it like, I guess I grew up in the 80s. And, anytime that I wanted to do research for writing papers or whatever, I had to go to my parents' Encyclopedia Britannica collection to do that research. Well, the internet came along. That was just a tool that kind of replaced what I was doing already. And I was able to use that tool to work even more quickly in whatever it was I was trying to create.
Yep.
All right. Well, last question for you. If you were to create a 5-song soundtrack or any number of songs, really, a soundtrack to the Hawk Method, what songs would you include?
Yeah, in general, it depends what I'm trying to accomplish, I think, with when it comes to music. Because I'm a very, I don't want to say, I do have an eclectic taste in music, but it's more of a diverse taste in music, where it's I love listening to 90s and early 2000s metal, but I also like early 90s hip hop, but I also like Motown. Like, it's kind of can be all over the place.
Yeah.
It depends on what I'm trying to do. If I'm trying to get after it and be aggressive and get out there, it's probably going to be like Rage Against the Machine, like Killing in the Name of, like, that's, love those guys. But if it's going to be, if I'm, you know, more relaxed, having a meeting on a Friday, hanging out, just talking about how we could do some business together, it might be more of Jack Johnson. Or I'm a big fan of like just 90s hits, because that's when I grew up. So like a 90s hits playlist might be in there. All the one hit wonders that came out of the 90s. There's periods even when I want to get after that, it's 90s hip hop, like some of the old school stuff I really like. So yeah, just depends. Honestly, it really depends. It's the mood I'm trying to drive is what I'm going for. And it's funny, my wife even says, like, you listen to some angry music, because when I work out or I snowboard, it's metal. And it's not, I have no angst or anger. It's not of my own. It's just like something about it just gets me pumped up. And that's what I'm going for. So it's driving mood with music is a big part of it. Little fun, since I know you asked that a lot, story I heard, Travis Kalanick, when he's like known, one of the best fundraisers of all time. And I forgot the song. I think it might be Welcome to the Jungle, but it was, he taught people, and he was one of them. If you're going in for a big pitch to raise money, to close a deal, have your pump up song. Because it really works. We tell our own sales team, like, before you get on the phone, play 2 minutes of that pump up song, get your mind right. Like, it works. It really does get the same way you have walkout music in baseball. Like, it works. There's something about that. So like that emotional side of music is huge.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like there are times, I'm not in as many high stakes meetings as I was in my previous career, but like there were times where, like, right before a big meeting, I would listen to certain pump up songs.
I'd say, what were your pump up songs?
So Eminem's Lose Yourself was always one of those. Every once in a while, and this goes back to what you were saying, you know, to help set my mood and to frame my mood. Sometimes, like, I would even not listen to music. I would listen to a quick stand up comedy routine to make myself feel totally comfortable and then make me happy and jovial going in.
100%. It's a good way to do it.
Yeah, it helps. Awesome. Well, Eric, thank you so much. I've learned so much from you today, but where can people go to learn more?
Hawkmedia.com if you want to learn on the marketing side, and then on every social @ Eric Huberman. Easy to find.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so grateful for your time today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my discussion with Eric Huberman. You can go and learn more from him and his team at hawkmedia.com. You'll find lots of resources and insights to help you take your marketing to the next level. And you'll find ways for Hawk Media to help simplify your marketing for you. They actually make it pretty simple compared to most other agencies through their a la carte and their month-to-month service. So whether it's strategy, branding, content, marketing, and everything in between, you'll find so many ways for Hawk Media to help your brand soar. And if you're enjoying the Simple Brand Podcast, go ahead and hit the subscribe button. It's going to make it so much simpler for you to get future episodes like the next one featuring Greg Kilstrom. Greg's a speaker, he's an entrepreneur, and he's a consultant to top companies on marketing technology, customer experience, and digital transformation. He's the host of the Agile Brand Podcast, and he's the best-selling author of 4 customer experience books, including his latest, House of the Customer, a blueprint for one-to-one, customer-first, employee-driven business transformation. Greg and I discuss his blueprint for building a customer-first, employee-driven enterprise that's based on 7 key elements he's identified that create a house that aligns your people, your processes, and your platforms to deliver a truly customer experience every time. So go ahead and subscribe. You'll automatically get Greg's episode as soon as it's live. Until then, keep it simple.